Welcome to City Club of Eugene, September 28th, 2018 program. Oregon House District 11 with candidates Mark Herbert and Marty Wilde. This is the fourth program of our 2018-2019 programming year. I'm Joel Curran, City Club President. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member or a sponsor at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Both business and in-kind sponsors we enjoy. Our diamond sponsor is Kaiser Permanente, that exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services and improve the health of our members and communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. And our Sapphire sponsor, Johnson & Johnson, Lucas & Middleton, P.C. The mission of the law offices of Johnson & Johnson, Lucas & Middleton is to obtain justice and fair compensation for people who have been harmed because of someone else's wrongful conduct. More information at justicelawyers.com. Our moderator today is Rachel McDonald of KLCC. Rachel is the interim program director at KLCC. She's been with the station for over 10 years. Previously, she established the Richmond, Washington Bureau for the Northwest News Network, and she also worked as the news director of KAZU in Monterey, California. Rachel has won numerous awards for her reporting. She was named the KLCC news director in June of 2018. And was so successful that she was immediately named the interim program director. They were so impressed until a permanent program director is hired. Rachel has a bachelor's degree in English from the University of Oregon, and Rachel will introduce the two candidates. Thank you.
Thank you, Joel. Thank you, City Club members and League of Women Voters, and welcome to today's forum. We will be hearing from both candidates for Oregon House District 11, and I'm going to introduce them and talk with you a little bit about the rules of the forum. So we'll have opening statements, 2 minutes each, and we've flipped a coin to see who goes first. So Marty Wilde will go first. And I'm going to introduce you first, though. And then we'll have 1 minute each for questions from the audience. And so each candidate will get to answer those questions for 1 minute. And then closing statements at the end will be 2 minutes. So I'll start by introducing Marty Wilde, Democratic candidate for House District 11. Born on the U of O campus, Marty Wilde grew up on an organic farm in the Coast Range. Thanks to food stamps, Medicaid, and public schools, he graduated college and joined the military to pay forward the support he had received from Oregonians. After 23 years of military service, 3 deployments, extensive volunteer service with the city and state to protect children and the elderly, and service as the director of a nonprofit, he is seeking to continue Representative Phil Barnhart's advocacy for education, health care, and a fair shot for all Oregonians. So why don't we go ahead and have you do your opening statement, and then I'll introduce Mark Herbert.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. The people of Oregon and the people of this country have done so much for me. They made sure I had access to education, healthcare, and housing. So when I graduated, I knew I wanted to pay that debt forward in public service. I joined the military, and for the last 24 years, I've been serving active and reserve. But when I came back from my last deployment to Afghanistan, I took a look around and I realized that we'd fallen from the ideals that helped people help me when I was a kid. Oregonians believe in healthcare. We believe in it so much that we put it in the Constitution. We set a minimum level, but we've never reached that level. This year we are at $1 billion below the minimum funding level that the voters established in the Constitution. $1 billion. That means kids that don't graduate. That means kids that graduate not ready to go to college and not ready for living wage fulfilling jobs. It means businesses that can't expand because they lack the workforce to do so. We need to reinvest in education for Oregonians. That's one of the things I want to fight for in Salem. We've done so much for healthcare, and there's still so much left to do. We've done a great job in Oregon cementing a woman's right to choose here and making sure we have full funding for it, regardless of her income or source of insurance. We've reduced the uninsured rate by 2/3 in Lane and Linn counties with the expansion of Medicaid. But there's still things we need to do. We need to protect people with pre-existing conditions, and we need to expand a public option, because if you make $17,000 as an individual or $35,000 as a family of four, you don't get OHP, and you can't afford the insurance you're likely to get. I want to talk, when I was knocking on doors last weekend, I met a woman, Betty. Betty's 97 years old and a Korean War veteran. She lives in a manufactured home in Glenwood. In some ways, we're doing well because the health care she receives through the Oregon Health Plan helps her stay in her home. But in some ways, we're not doing well because a $25 a month rent increase she got, capping a doubling of her rent, risks putting her on the street. I want to work for Betty, and I want to work for you, because the best investments we can make in Oregon are investments in people. Thank you.
Thank you. Mark Herbert is running for Oregon House District 11 as a Republican. He has 30 years of experience as a management consultant, business and human resources executive with a focus on human resources, organizational development, and strategic planning. Client base represents healthcare, financial services, food processing, high technology, education, and not-for-profit sectors. His prior governmental experience includes being the former Lane County Planning Commission member and chairperson, former board member of the Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce, and Lane Metro Partnership. Mark Herbert.
Good afternoon. Thank you to the City Club and the League of Women Voters for giving me this opportunity to present myself for consideration to you as a candidate. As Rachel mentioned, I have a fairly extensive background as a business executive, as a small business owner, as a consultant, and probably right now the role that I'm most proud of, and that is the interim executive director of a not-for-profit serving one of the most vulnerable parts of our population, the developmentally disabled. What I like to think that you will see pretty consistently with that track record is that I have brought people together with differing viewpoints to create meaningful solutions that work for everybody. And let's talk about some of those solutions that we need to address. There are multiple things that I think we need to address in our district and in the state of Oregon, but there are a few that are particularly key to me. The first is creating and maintaining a stable economic environment. Bill Gates once said that businesses can't succeed in communities that fail. I would say to you the inverse is true as well. If we do not have a robust and stable economic environment, then the society can't win it as well. The second thing that is a big concern to me is if we take a look at the performance of our K through 12 educational system in Oregon, we have a 77% graduation rate. That means almost one in four students isn't completing high school. And that's an improvement over where it was. I think a big part of that is that we stopped investing a few years back in vocational and career and technical education, which has a huge impact on it. Those can move the numbers. Then we also have significant issues with homelessness, affordable housing, and I would submit to you that part of that is Lane County has a distinction of being number 7 out of the 7 major counties in Oregon on 2 key indicators, job growth and wage growth. Those things all connect up, and I think what I bring to the party is the ability to bring people together to create systemic solutions to root cause issues. And I think that's what we need in Salem. We need a little less acrimony, we need a little less pointing fingers, and we need more solutions for all of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you both. We will now start questions, and some of these questions have been prepared by the League of Women Voters, some by the City Club audience here. I wanted to ask a question that I came up with. Politics have become more partisan than ever. We've witnessed this week the Kavanaugh hearings where partisan politics were on display. Do you have any ideas for how to bridge the divide and change the dynamics between parties? We'll go ahead and start with Marty Wilde.
You know, I can only point to my history of working across the aisle. The leader of the other party in the House is Mike McLean. Mike McLean used to work for me in the Guard, in the legal office in Portland, when we were both in the Air National Guard. And, you know, we used to argue politics because we like to argue politics. But we both sworn an oath to a higher purpose, and we both worked hard for that oath. And so when it came time to evaluate our performance together, the Air Force awarded us a national award for the base, for the work we'd done to support our airmen. So that's the history I have. And in terms of Salem, I think it really does come down to personal relationships and being willing to work across the aisle with people you may not agree with, but can still respect. Thank you.
Mark Herbert?
Absolutely. What we're seeing in Salem, what we're seeing in Washington is acrimonious and unnecessary. What I found as a human resources professional is when I entered the field, there was an idea that says that the needs and the interests of employers and employees were different. I didn't believe that was true 35 years ago when I entered the field, and I don't believe that today. I think the same thing is true in politics. I think what we need to do is focus on what we can agree on. The moderator made the comment, and it was made before, that one of the things you've seen that distinguishes this campaign from many others is the lack of acrimony between Marty and I. And I think a big part of that is because we agree on what the issues are. And that's where it starts, a civil discourse. Let's focus on what is important about making Oregon a better Oregon. And I think when we do that, we can do that together. And I think I have a track record of demonstrating that, working in union and non-union environments, bringing people together, and building communities. And that's how you start. You role model the appropriate behavior. Let's start with Oregon and not worry about Washington. We can show them the way.
We have a lot of questions about some of the ballot measures that are on the ballot for November. And we'll start, take a look at a couple. We've got measures 102, municipal bonds for affordable housing. Let's hear what you think about that particular measure, and we'll start with you, Mark Herbert.
As I indicated in my opening remarks, affordable housing is a huge issue, not just for the state, but for the country. And I think any time that we can create an opportunity for public-private partnership to address that issue, I think it's a good thing. So I think changing the bonds and giving that opportunity to create those kinds of partnerships is absolutely a positive thing, and I support that measure.
I support the measure as well. It's important that kids grow up in environments where they meet people who aren't like themselves. And one of the great advantages of Measure 102 and why I support it is it will allow the kind of public and private partnerships that make sure that kids live in diverse environments where they can meet people who might be wealthier and might be poorer than them. I grew up poor, and I had the opportunity to meet a lot of different folks. It informed my worldview, and it helped me understand the limitations of my own perspective and appreciate what other people bring to conversation. Thank you.
And Measure 103 would ban taxes on groceries in Oregon. Marty Wilde, what's your opinion on that one?
I don't support Measure 103 because, one, we don't need to put it in the Constitution. Nobody's talking about taxing food, and the definition of groceries is overbroad. It might include other things that we might legitimately want to tax, for instance, to fund schools. So I don't support taxes on food, but I think this measure isn't written particularly well, and so I do not support Measure 103. Thank you.
Mark Herbert?
I'm afraid I take an opposing view. I don't support the measure. I think that when you start allowing the potential for taxation, it can become a slippery slope. And I have always come from a place that the best way to address things is to increase revenues rather than taxes. I am concerned that the kinds of things like a grocery tax is an aggressive tax. That's the kind of thing that is going to impact economically disadvantaged people more so than others. And so I'm concerned about that. And I just, you know, I think the solution is build the economy, don't provide more taxes on things.
So just to be clear, Mark. Okay, so you would support 103? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. So how about Measure 104, which would establish a supermajority for revenue changes in Oregon? And Mark Herbert, we'll start with you. We'll just switch turns.
Yes, and I am, in fact, in support of that. I think that a tax is a tax, and I think that there's a big difference between pluralities and majorities. I think especially when we look at a situation where, if we look at the legislature in Oregon today, where we have one party that dominates that, I get concerned about that. And my concern is not because of what the party is. I think that the old expression of power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think when you have imbalance, I think imbalance creates imbalance. And that's why I think the supermajority is very, very important if we're talking about things like taxation.
I oppose the measure because corporations need to pay their fair share. Corporations used to bring in 18% of revenue to the state. Now they bring in 6.7%. That's been through the steady erosion of their taxes through deductions and credits. What this measure would do was put a supermajority not just on new taxes, but on the reduction of deductions and credits. That's anti-democratic, and that's just another way that C corporations are trying to favor shareholders over people in this state. We need revenue to pay for the services that Oregonians demand and have enshrined in our Constitution, and this is just a way for corporations to avoid paying their fair share. Thank you.
Thank you. Continuing down the measures on the ballot, what about Measure 105? That would make Oregon no longer a sanctuary state.
I oppose Measure 105. I have served as a prosecutor in both a sanctuary state and a non-sanctuary state. I would say having the sanctuary state designation did not hurt me in any way. As a state prosecutor, I was not concerned about someone's status, and I needed to be able to reassure victims that regardless of their documentation status, that they were going to receive justice in our system. So I have signed visas for crime victims, and I don't believe that we should be in a position of enforcing unjust federal laws in the state system. I would also say I'm very pleased because I myself sponsored 7 immigrants to the U.S. When my interpreter, his family, came under threat for his work we'd done in Afghanistan, I signed the paperwork to get him to the U.S., and I saw how difficult that system is. It took 3 years to get him here. I'm pleased to say he got here in 2014, and next year he and his family will be eligible to U.S. citizens. Immigrants built this country, and they continue to build this country. We need to treat them fairly.
Mark Herbert?
As the grandchild of immigrants, I also oppose removing the sanctuary status. I think if we take a look at where things are, we have many other places to invest our energies. For the most part, our public safety resources are underfunded at the state, county, and local levels. So having them chase something that is, at least at this stage in my mind, not an issue, doesn't seem to be a good place to be investing resources. And it's unnecessary. It may have some political cachet to it, but I think in terms of the real impact of it, it just doesn't bring anything to the party.
Okay. And finally, Measure 106, which would end taxpayer funding for abortions in Oregon. And Mark Herbert, would you answer that first?
I am conflicted about the whole issue of abortion, to be candid with you. I am what I would refer to as pro-choice and against abortion. On the other hand, I am a firm believer in a woman's reproductive rights, that she needs to control those reproductive rights. I would rather see us focus on education, on other types of things to prevent pregnancies, but the point is, those things happen. There are people who run into situations where they have an unwanted pregnancy. In some cases, that's a function of rape. In some cases, other circumstances, a woman should not be denied her opportunity to receive an abortion for that.
I oppose Measure 106 because I am 100% pro-choice. A choice without access isn't a real choice. What we see is that Measure 106 would say, well, if you happen to receive your health insurance from a public entity, you don't get the same choices as somebody who receives it from a private entity. This would disadvantage not only people who are on OHP, but it would disadvantage people who work for the state, our public employees. Why should your teachers, why should your firefighters, why should your police have fewer choices about their health care than you do? I think it's only fair that we say no on 106.
The last education K-12 budget for Oregon was $8.1 billion with Measure 98. What is your ideal education budget, and how would you fully fund education in Oregon? We'll start with you, Marty Wilde.
Thank you. According to the quality education model, the appropriate budget, the minimum budget necessary to give children an adequate public education, is about $10 billion per biennium. That means we're $1 billion short a year, a full 20% below the constitutional minimum. That's not what I'd like it to be. We are far below where we need to be to make sure that kids can access those career and technical education programs, to make sure we have them, to make sure that kids are prepared to do that. How should we fund it? As I said before, in my opposition to Measures 103 and 104, corporations need to pay their fair share. They used to pay a lot more. You know, right now, for every dollar you pay as individuals, corporations pay only 8.3 cents for their corporate income tax. That's appalling. we are not, they're not paying their fair share that they need to. The Student Success Commission has a fairly enlightened proposal that would adjust the corporate minimum taxes to deal with the fact that corporations have been eroding their tax liability through means fair and foul for the last 40 years. Thank you.
I agree that education needs to be fully funded. I disagree on the methodology. If we take a look at it, I think one of the ways that we can fund education is there are 150,000 open jobs in Oregon right now, family wage jobs where employers can't find people to do that work. If those 150,000 people become employed, that's 150,000 additional people that are paying taxes. Also, if we take a look at the situation in Lane County, I want to remind you that I mentioned statistically that we are number 7 out of 7 in job growth and wage growth. What I would submit to you is that's a big reason for the funding shortfall, is when you don't have businesses, when you don't have employment, when people aren't paying taxes, that revenue isn't there. My solution is not split the pie. My solution is let's come together collaboratively and build a bigger pie. I know for a fact in working with my clients, they're investing in education because they recognize those are their future employees. Those are the children of their employees. That's the future of their economy. I'd like to see a little bit more collaboration and a little bit less regulation. Let's come together.
Thank you. How do you feel the next redistricting should be handled in Oregon? And Mark Herbert, we'll start with you.
I would like to see it handled by a bipartisan commission.
Okay, short answer. Marty Weldy?
I too would like to see nonpartisan redistricting. I think though it is better for us to consider all the other things that have grown up around it. The 3/5 majority for raising revenue occurred because we have a partisan redistricting system. So it's not just a matter of changing one thing. I think we do need to change that. I think we do need to eliminate the 3/5 majority because I want to enable you. I want to enable the voters to vote for the people you want to elect, and those people you elect should be able to make decisions about how to fund the services that you demand. And so I think, yes, we need to work on the infrastructure of our democracy. That includes supermajority requirements, and it also includes nonpartisan redistricting. It's important that we look at these things holistically, and we do a good, competent job restructuring Oregon's system to make it more democratic, not less.
Much of Oregon environmental policy has been historically been written with the timber industry in mind. Should this change? And if so, what should we base our state's environmental policies? And we'll start with you, Marty Wilde.
You know, there's two things I'd like to talk about. First is the cap and invest bill. That would cap our carbon emissions. I have some indication it's going to get a vote in the Senate this time around, and I hope it does pass. I would say I think that will benefit us all, those of us who live in cities who have traditionally supported this, but also people who live in the countries, because I think some of that investment is going to be investment in rural infrastructure. One of the ways we know we can get cars off the road, for instance, is by reducing the 85% of people in Cresswell who commute to Eugene and Springfield, by giving them jobs in their own community. We know we can do that with $1 million investment in transportation infrastructure to enable the Bald Knob development to be developed. There are lots of things we can do to do that. I am also fully supportive of reforming the Oregon Forest Practices Act. I've had friends die from aerial spraying. I was only spared it because my dad was an organic farmer and had our land tested. So I think it's important that we build appropriate buffers around our streams to protect them and ban aerial spraying. Thank you.
First of all, this may be an unpopular position, but I don't accept the fact that most of the environmental law in Oregon has been written around forest practices. So I'm going to say just on its face, I'm not going to accept that as fact. What I do believe is environmental law, environmental regulations need to have balance. I think one of the best laws that were written many, many years ago when environmentalists and the timber industry came together and balanced the interest of all parties. I think that's what environmental law needs to do, is it needs to come from a place of balance. Also, in terms of cap and trade, I'm not a fan, okay? I look at it as a bait and switch, okay? What you basically do is you're not reducing emissions. What you're just doing is you pay credits for it. So we're not necessarily reducing those emissions, we're just moving the deck chairs around the Titanic. All law should be balanced. We should be looking at the impact of everybody that we impact and write the law from that perspective, not from the perspective of one group or the other.
So Mark Herbert, this question is aimed at you, but both of you can answer it. What specific changes do you advocate to achieve the robust economic environment you desire?
Some of the things that I'd like to see done is I would like to see more partnership between the private and public sector. Like I said, we're seeing some of those examples out there. A great example out not too far from where I live is where companies are collaborating with Mohawk High School because they needed people in skilled crafts. Those companies came out there and actually worked with the school board there to develop a training program where people can get trained and go through an apprenticeship program and actually come out of high school with a job. I think there are opportunities to expand that. I think there are opportunities for us to come together like we did here in Eugene 20 years ago when we were trying to bring high tech into here, where we collaborated with LCC to provide a training program to make us more attractive to bring businesses here. I'd like to see in our county here, I think there's a great opportunity to capitalize on the healthcare and biosciences infrastructure we have to build a robust biosciences infrastructure that provides high-wage jobs, clean jobs, and so those are the things I'd like to see happening.
I approach this from the perspective of workforce. I was talking with Sabrina Parsons from Palo Alto Software. I run the medical society. She hires a lot of people in the tech sector. And we both talked about how difficult it was to train people here and to attract talent from other places because of the state of our schools. When I talk to other business people, they say, I would love to expand, but I don't have the workforce. Those 150,000 jobs, that about matches the unemployment rate in Oregon, but those people aren't trained for those jobs. I believe that corporations should pay more in their income taxes, but I also think they're going to see a very concrete benefit in terms of having better trained workforce. And, you know, in addition to living in a society where we can attract better people and have people live better lives in that. So I'm in favor of increasing the educated workforce so that businesses can expand and save money on the training that they need to do now. Thank you.
Thank you. For our radio audience, this is the City Club of Eugene. This forum is sponsored by the City Club and by the League of Women Voters of Lane County. And we're hearing from Mark Herbert, who's running as a Republican for House District 11, and Marty Wilde, who's running as a Democrat for House District 11. And the next question is about health insurance. Should health insurance be able to deny care or increase prices for people with pre-existing conditions, or how would you approach that issue? And we'll start with Marty Wilde.
Right now, that's prohibited by federal law. We need to make sure that's prohibited by state law as well. We've seen too many attacks by the Trump administration on the parts of the ACA that are working well. And that's one that has almost uniform agreement. So I can't control what they do in Washington, D.C., but we definitely need to cement that in Oregon to make sure that everybody has affordable health care because, you know, life is a pre-existing condition. We all have knocks and dings that accumulate over the years, and nobody should be denied care or denied affordable care because they've had, you know, a life. Thank you.
Mark Herbert?
Yes. Marty and I agree. No one should be denied health care because of a pre-existing condition, and that's at the federal level and the state level. What I'd actually like to see us do is take more of a leadership role in addressing not the expense of health care, but the management of health. As a human resources professional for 35 years, I found when we worked with our employees and educated them and got them involved in the management of their own health, we were both able to reduce expenses and we were able to improve health. That benefited us and it benefited them. We had healthier employees, we had healthier families, and one of the ancillary benefits to us as a business is it saved us money. But the idea of denying people care because of an existing is just wrong.
Going back to education, what are the burdens that you see with seeking higher education, and how would you alleviate these burdens? I'll start with you, Mark Herbert.
In terms of the burden of seeking higher education, I think a better question for us to ask ourselves is whether or not it is not required and necessary for all citizens of Oregon to seek higher education. And I think that's a premise that we've taken, that every person in Oregon needs to get a college education. I don't know if that's necessary. The burdens, it's expensive. I think in many cases what we also have is we need to do a better job of orienting students, where we have students coming out of college with very expensive degrees that are not relevant and then can't find a job. So I think we also need to look at how are we guiding students to say, is your education appropriate to both your interest, your values, and frankly, are you going to be able to find employment with it? Because having an expensive degree that doesn't get you a job isn't very helpful.
We established a goal of 40-40-20 in this state years ago, and it was met with uniform acclaim because we believe that everyone should have access to higher education. That includes university education, but it also includes higher education in places like LCC and Lynn Benton Community College. It includes apprenticeships through the building trades. One of the reasons businesses can't expand is They need to build things, and they don't have the skilled tradespeople to do it. I would love it if we could connect more kids with career and technical education to enter those things. Yeah, and sure, when you become a union electrician, you're going to have about an associate's degree, and maybe you choose to continue to go on in electrical engineering. Some will choose that path. Some will choose another path. But the problem we have here is we've under-supported higher education for so long that we're scaring off students with just sticker shock about how much it takes. We adopted this high-aid, high-tuition model that's more appropriate for a private university than a public university or public college. We need to stabilize and reduce tuition, and we need to help people who want to go into public service but have too much debt to do so.
Thank you. This questioner says, I've always supported more funding for schools, but it's getting hard to do that when I see that most of the additional funding will go to pay PERS costs. How can we fix the PERS problem so we can afford the services we need? Can it be changed? In 1 minute. Marty Wilde, we'll start with you.
The short answer to can PERS be changed is, how much do you want to cheat firefighters, police, teachers, and other public servants out of the retirements they earned? Yes, we made a bad deal in the late 80s, and instead of giving them the wage increases they wanted, we entered into this gamble with them about their retirement systems. And that's where we ended up where we are today. Fortunately, we ended that system for new entrants in 2003, and so nobody new is coming into that. Are there things we can do around the edges? Yes, absolutely. But when you read the Supreme Court's decision on the subject, it's absolutely clear that the majority of this is already baked in the cake. We made a deal. And you know, any more that if you thought a bank that you had $1,000 in and you walked in tomorrow and they said, well, you know, you have $500 today because we didn't like the contract, so we rewrote it. The state is bound by its contracts as well. So yes, we are going to have to raise revenue. The good news about PERS is if we do, it's baked into the quality education model. So if we do fully fund education, we will partially be taking care of the PERS problem as well.
As I understand that the current liability for PERS is $28 billion. That is a huge burden. It is a significant issue. To Marty's point, much of that burden is commitments that we made in the past. So what I think we do have to do is we have to look at the structure of PERS moving forward and make it more appropriate, because I think there are parts of PERS right now that just don't work. I don't think that it was ever intended that recipients of PERS could retire at higher incomes than they are actually making as an employee, and that situation occurs. So I think what you can do is, even with a contract, is you can open a dialogue. Earlier this year, I was faced with a situation in my not-for-profit where we committed to a 5% pay increase for the folks in our union. I had to sit down with them and tell them we were $500,000 in the hole. The only way I could fund that increase was to lay off a third of the workforce. So we sat down with union leadership, and we came together and came up with a way to fund it. 5 months later, we were able to pay them their increase. We were able to restore the reserves because we sat down and had a dialogue about what was more important to us. Was it their raises, or was it fulfilling our mission?
Thank you. What can you do to provide income and shelter for homeless people in Oregon? And we'll start with you, Mark Herbert.
In the developmentally disabled community, we have an expression that says, when you've met a person with autism, you've met a person with autism. So the first thing I think we need to look at and say, everyone is not homeless for the same reasons. So I think the first thing we need to do is we need to triage the homeless population and find out what kinds of different homeless people we have and what is the root cause of that homelessness. I think when we have people that are suffering from other issues, core issues, mental health and things like that, I think we need to get them stabilized. We need to get them in a shelter, because until we get them sheltered, until we attend to Maslow's first part of the hierarchy of needs, we're not going to get to the rest of it. And so I think that there are places for public-private partnership to look at that, to address that, and saying, let's get to those root causes, and let's get people as much as possible off the street. I think with others, what you do is you try to provide them with a transition to a purpose, get them off the street, get them in jobs. And I think that we have models out there that are working that can do that.
Thank you.
Housing first is the model that we should pursue. When we see people on the street, they have a lot of needs. But the model we've adopted here is housing first, that if you're sleeping rough, if you're sleeping on the street, if you're sleeping in a box, you're not going to be able to deal with the other problems you have. So housing first, we need to get folks off the street. We need to build more housing. You know, not just for the homeless, but all the way up through workforce housing. Once you're off the street, then we need to provide health care. We have a great system. we need to work on mental health care. There are a lot of folks who need access to that, but we just don't have it. The mental health system under OHP isn't what it should be, and we need to reinforce that as well. And only then are really people in a position to take a job. You know, if you have Hep C and you're in liver failure, you're not going to be able to get a job. You know, if you are in the throes of an addiction, you're not going to be able to hold a job. So I think it's important that we start with housing, we move to healthcare, and then we work on jobs. And housing is something that stretches across those. We need housing to get them off the street, we need housing while they're in recovery, and we need housing for them when they're working. Thank you.
Thank you. This question is about cap and trade. There are supporters of cap and trade. This questioner says 40% of Republican voters in Oregon support a cap and trade program for Oregon, but that 0% of Republican legislators do. How do we get more Republican lawmakers to join the majority of what this questioner says is the majority of Oregonians who support cap and trade? And Marty, we'll start with you, please.
I mean, to answer the last part of that question, first, I support cap and invest, as we call it here, or cap and trade. How do you get businesses to support it? I think you show them the benefits, how they are going to benefit. There are industries that would have excess credits to sell and would like to sell them. You also show them how the investments that we're going to make in infrastructure are going to primarily benefit them. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. A lot of the money that we raise through Cap and Invest is going to come from roads, and it's going to have to go back to the transportation sector. But there are so many projects that would keep people in Cresswell working in Cresswell and keep people in Harrisburg able to work in Harrisburg. Those are the kind of rural infrastructure investments we can make. So the question is, how do we convince businesses and Republicans to come around to it? I think you show them the benefits. I think we are going to get to a cap and invest bill. I know they're working very hard on the details to do it, and the details matter in something like this. So I have some confidence that we'll get a bill through this time, and it'll be one that not only helps people in the environment, but it also helps our business community as well.
Mark Herbert, cap and invest, cap and trade.
Cap and invest. I think the issue here is, as a representative of the people, if you have 40% of your population telling you that they support something, that's a message. And I think whether you're Democrat, Republican, or whatever you want to call yourself, you need to remember that your job is to represent the people who sent you to Salem. So that's a fundamental disconnect. I think, as Marty pointed out, if there are solutions, if we can show people, you know, why a policy works or doesn't work, I think that's the approach to take to it. But to just look at the fact and say that this is merely a Republican or Democratic issue, I don't necessarily believe that. I think what you need to do is education. I think that people have a lot of strong positions on both sides of the aisle about a lot of things. And I think what you do is you bring people together, you talk about where we can agree, and you move from those points of agreement out to trying to resolve the points and solutions that we can all support.
Can you each share your perspective and thoughts for how to solve the problem of opioid addiction in Oregon? Mark Herbert?
Wow.
And you have 1 minute.
Yeah. Opioid addiction is a national crisis. I think it starts with access. I think it starts with overprescribing. I think it's a very, very complicated issue. I will be the first one to tell you is I do not have an immediate solution to that. That's a complicated issue. I think a big part of it, as I mentioned before, about the management of health versus the management of healthcare is education. It's collaboration. This is a societal issue that we're going to have to fix societally. And I would love to be able to tell you as a freshman legislator that I have that solution in my pocket and I can take that to Salem, but I would be overstating my capabilities significantly to tell you I can fix that issue.
We need to get people off opioids. We've seen a lot of success in reducing prescriptions for opioids in the civilian community. There's still a huge problem with the VA. People don't realize it, but the Roseburg VA has the highest prescribing rates for opioids in the country. An appropriate prescribing rate for your opioids is about 3% of your total prescriptions. The VA in Roseburg is at 20%. So we need to work with our federal partners to reduce that. And how do you do it? It's not that you let people's pain go untreated. It's that you treat it in the ways that it work. We know that long-term treatment on opioids just doesn't work. People end up feeling a lot of pain, and they end up with a lot of problems from taking high levels. So we need to fund the physical therapy and other services, chiropractic, massage, yoga. These are the things that help people get over their chronic pain problems. We also need to acknowledge that there are certain people who are just going to need opioids. If you have terminal cancer, then you are going to be on a fairly high level of opioids, so you can function and be happy in the time you have remaining. But we do have a huge problem, and part of it is lack of uniformity and cooperation between our healthcare partners.
Thank you. What strategies should the state of Oregon undertake to improve passenger and freight rail service, both to reduce freeway traffic and to ensure market access for Oregon products? So it's kind of a two-part question.
I ended up talking to Union Pacific, and the first question they asked me is, are you going to complain about the train down from Portland for the Ducks game? And I said, no. They said, this is probably the last time you'll talk to me and not complain about that. The advantage we have right here is we could really improve the port facilities in Coos Bay. I don't support Jordan Cove, but I do support upgrading the rail line there because we've largely shut down the port in Portland. And the port in Coos Bay is a great port, has access to the high seas. We could do it. We could get a lot of trucks off the road, and we could reduce carbon emissions if we make those investments. Why do people in Coos Bay care so much about the timber industry, even though it doesn't employ them much? Because we haven't done any economic development in that part of the world to give them something else to care about. I think we need that. I think rail is a big piece of that. We also need to work on passenger rail in terms of timeliness. As someone who takes the train up to Portland and Salem quite frequently, the reliability and timeliness is an issue, and I think we definitely need to work with our federal partners on that.
The current rail infrastructure is in need of significant work. In terms of repair, in terms of functionality, in terms of efficiency. And I think that there are opportunities to look at best practices elsewhere. You go to Europe, you go to other places, they're doing an excellent job. So not only do I not think we're not doing a terribly good job in Oregon, we're not doing a terribly good job in the United States. And one of the things I learned as a corporate guy, go find out somebody that's doing it really, really well, and what are they doing well, and how do we bring those ideas there? And that's the thing. That infrastructure needs to be replaced, and it needs to be fixed. And that's how you create that. I think passenger rail is a viable solution, but we're going to have to put the infrastructure in there to make that happen.
How can Oregon improve services for the mentally ill, including those who end up incarcerated rather than treated? And Mark Herbert, please take that one first.
This is a huge issue. One of the areas where I think that we can assist in that area is we can work on the issue of the fact that we have a critical shortage of trained healthcare professionals in the state of Oregon at every level. And I think that's part of the issue, is just having people who are actually trained to do the assessment and a diagnosis and get them help. I think when we start there, I'd also like to see us be able to put resources in other parts of the infrastructure. I'd like to see it in the school systems so that we can catch people early and start to address those. So I think it's a combination of having the right infrastructure in place and to make it a societal solution, a systemic solution. But the biggest part is we're going to have to have the professionals, the trained professionals that can assist in that. That's step one.
We can improve the mental health system in several ways. The first I would say is the compensation rates are quite low for mental health providers compared to physical health providers. And what that means is people don't get the training and they don't want to stay in our towns and cities and provide them. We also know that, especially in OHP, there have been enormous delays in payment. We're talking 8 or 9 months between the delivery of the service and the payment for it. That's something we really need to work on. And as we move into reprocurement for OHP and the CCOs, coordinated care organizations, we need to set some standards to make sure that they're getting paid on time. We need to embrace medication-assisted treatment for people who are suffering from addictions. It's not just a matter of gutting it out and going cold turkey. There's a significant reduction in deaths if you provide people with medication-assisted treatment, and they are much more likely to stay sober. We also need to divert people from the criminal justice system. If they have a mental health problem, they need mental health treatment, not to end up in our prisons, where it'll just cost more to treat them and curtail their liberties and our freedom as a society. Thank you.
In campaign literature, both of you mentioned experience of military life as an asset for future service in the legislature. Can you give examples of how what you learned in the military can inform your work as a representative? Marty Wilde?
You know, when I went off to basic training at Fort Benning in the infantry, they made it absolutely clear that they didn't care about our individuality. That we were there to do a job, and yes, we were individuals, but we were expected to work together, and frankly, our opinions didn't matter that much. It was to me, as to many people, a bit of a wake-up call, but it did definitely show me how we can work together. And that is a lesson that has endured throughout my career. It's funny, now I'm at a fairly senior level in the military, and I go to these councils of colonels, and we talk about the things we need to get done, and we agree on a lot, and we get a lot of progress, and then, you know, we'll go socialize afterwards, and then we'll talk about things that don't involve work. We realize how little we agree on politics and things like that. But that commitment to working together and getting things done for a common cause is something that I definitely take away from military service. It's been probably the most profound lesson of my life. Thank you.
Unlike Marty, I have not had the privilege of serving in the military. However, I grew up in a military family where my father was a 30-year military guy. I have a brother that served. I have nephews and nieces that are serving today. I also work right now with transitioning special operations people, and one of the things that comes away from working with them is that is a group of people that understand something very clearly, and that is a sense of mission and a sense of purpose. As Marty indicated, it isn't about you, the individual, it's about the mission, and that is something that I take away from me every time I work with those people. Any of you that ever had the opportunity to read Simon Sinek's Start With Why, the interesting thing of working with that group, their why is very, very clear to them. In fact, one of the toughest things I have to explain to them is when you go out into corporate America, that why isn't as clear. You're used to working with people who we have each other's back. The mission is very clear. The mission is more important than any of the rest of us. So out there in the world, and I'm not going to call it the real world, that's not necessarily the case. So that's something that's informed me, is whenever you're working with a population of people, start with why. What is the why of what we're trying to do? Then talk about the what.
Can you tell us how you would work with elected officials and other stakeholders to address Oregon's tax system and revenue shortfalls? And Mark Herbert, you go first.
Carefully and slowly. No. I think the big thing is, as we've talked about, the best way to work with any group with diverse opinions is to start with what can we agree on. I think that there are many, many issues, no matter what your political party or your viewpoint, that we recognize as significant issues impacting the state of Oregon overall. You start with those things. And when you can create that sense of why and what we're trying to accomplish, you can build out from that to have those. I think what you also do is you bring that dialogue constructively. We stop the labeling. We stop the name calling. We don't talk about us and them. We talk about we, and we focus that way. I think that's a track record that I've spent the last 35 years doing, is saying, let's focus on where we agree first, and then let's work out to the edges. And that's where I'd start as a legislator.
We need to make sure we get back to basics. That means providing education and health care for Oregonians. The two big revenue bills that are likely to come up in the session are the student success bill. Like I said, that's about getting large corporations to once again pay their fair share so that kids today have the same opportunities that Oregonians 40 years ago gave me in public school. The second big one is the health care bill. There's some complex reasons for it, but the federal rate is dropping a little. We need to make sure that we're boosting access to care through the Oregon Health Plan. And we've had a lot of collaboration with healthcare providers who are willing to tax themselves to provide healthcare, but this next jump is going to be more than they can handle on their own. And so we're going to have to look at other taxes. And what's been really enlightening to me is their willingness to hold education harmless, that people in healthcare really think education is important. So we've been looking at things like tobacco taxes because we know they relate directly to care. And we also know that our tobacco taxes are only 40% of California's and Washington's. We don't want to be a destination for cigarettes. Thank you.
Do you support the National Popular Vote Campaign or Compact? If so, what would you do to move this forward in Oregon? And if not, please explain how you believe Oregon voters are best represented in the U.S. presidential election.
I do support the National Popular Vote, and I've committed to voting for the bill in the House. The issue has been in the Senate, and we're finally hearing some language that maybe it'll get a hearing. There's some desire on the Senate side to send it to the voters. I'm certainly not afraid of the voters in doing that. The question is just, do we want to pass it and they can refer it if they want, or do we want to pass it and have them vote on it? From my perspective, I would prefer to pass it, and if people don't like it, then they can refer it. We certainly have that process, but you know, I'm not running for the Senate, so there's a limit to what I can do on that side of the aisle. But I do fully support the National Popular Vote.
I do not support the National Popular Vote. My primary reason for that is the National Popular Vote gives disproportionate influence to heavily populated areas. I think one of the things we need to remember is 25% of the population in the United States lives between Boston and Washington. That gives them a lot of votes. That gives them a lot of influence. One of the reasons the Electoral College was created is to create that sense of balance. If we take a look at Oregon, we have a significant part of the population of Oregon that is on the I-5 corridor. but there's a lot of Oregonians that don't live on the I-5 corridor. So those kinds of things, they just look at it as a law of numbers, don't create that balance. So I think there is an opportunity to create the model where we look at both. But just the law of numbers is not something I'm comfortable with for the reasons I stated.
So we've got time for one more question, and then we'll go to our closing statements. What would be, if you were elected, what are your top three legislative priorities? Mark Herbert?
Top three legislative priorities are economic stability, improving our educational infrastructure, and using those two to address the issues with affordable housing, homelessness, and some of the other societal issues that we face.
My top three would be education funding. We've been falling below the constitutional limit for far too long. We have to find, second, I would talk about Oregon Health Plan funding, that we need to find stable funding for the Oregon Health Plan and make sure we continue that very successful program. And third, I would talk about housing. The reality is we hold cities and counties responsible for planning for growth. We have not required them to actually grow and build housing, and that's leading us to homelessness problems. That's leading us to people being unable to afford rent, and that's leading us to a situation where people cannot afford to buy a house. Thank you.
Since you went so fast, I'm going to throw in one more question. Do you have plans to introduce any particular legislation, and if so, please describe it?
I strongly favor a public option. We are failing people in the middle of the income spectrum. We're failing people who are fairly low on the income spectrum. I don't think $35,000 a year is enough to raise a family on, but it's enough to disqualify you from the Oregon Health Plan. When I think about my friend John Borofsky, who owns a couple of pizzerias, and I asked him if he could afford to provide health care, he said no. I said, okay, for the sake of argument, what could you afford? He said, well, for a full-time employee, maybe $3,000 a year. Well, that's not going to get you a commercial plan. But, you know, for a single waitress with one kid working at one of his things, $3,000 is a large part of what it would cost to get her on OHP. And so I think that's a critical public option. And I think laying that foundation of a public option leads us down the road to a single-payer system. And I would like to see that as well. But I realize that we've got to convince the voters that that's the right thing to do. Thank you.
Any legislation you have plans to introduce?
Yes, probably the single my biggest initial agenda would be we made a commitment to fully fund career and technical education, and we haven't done it. I'd like to go back and look at that budget and find those dollars, because I think that that's a critical investment now and for the future. And I think that means looking at how we're not just what we're collecting, but how we're spending it. And I think that that is an investment that will show long-term gains in a number of different areas, ranging from the quality of our workforce and the quality of people's lives to healthcare and all of those other things. And so I think that's a critical place to start.
So we'll now have our closing statements, 2 minutes each, and Marty Wilde will go first.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. We've knocked on over 20,000 doors in my campaign. We're not afraid of the voters, and we're not afraid of democracy. And what's been surprising to me is not the division. What's been surprising to me is how much we agree on. We agree on education. We agree on health care. We agree on housing. We believe that seniors should stay in their homes as they age. And we believe that veterans, that the battle isn't over for veterans when they get home, that they need to be connected with housing, health care, and the others, and work, at the services they need. I've had some wonderful opportunities in 24 years of public service and service in my community. I've been able to serve as a court-appointed special advocate for children and advocate for them as a PTO leader, a parent-teacher organization leader in the schools. I've had the opportunity to advocate for seniors, to keep them in their homes for the Senior Law Service and for their rights in long-term care and for their dignity in long-term care as an ombudsman there. I've had great opportunities to lead in the community, not just here at City Club, but also on the City Budget Committee, preserving services for the homeless, and also on the Police Commission, moving to a more community-based community policing model where we are more connected with the community. What I hear is agreement. I hear that people want representatives who will fight for the investments they want to make, investments so that children can get fulfilling jobs that from the education that they receive, living wage jobs. They want people to be able to afford health care, which they believe is a human right. They want affordable housing. They want to keep seniors in their homes. And they want to make sure that our veterans get the services they need. I want to fight for people like Betty. I want to fight for people like you. I want to fight for Oregon to make the investments in the future. And those are investments in people. Thank you very much, and I hope I earn your vote this November.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to present my reasons for running to you. I'd like to think that what you see with both of us candidates is two individuals who are committed to public service. Marty did so in the military. And thank you for your service, and thank you to all of the veterans. I chose to perform my public service in a different way, through working with businesses to grow businesses, from training leaders for the last 35 years, to working with organizations of all sizes to try to reach across the island and build situations where we came together to build stronger communities. I would like to see us bring more cooperation and collaboration and less regulation to the issues that are facing Oregon today. I want to remind you that we are number 7 out of 7 in job growth and wage growth. I don't think that increasing taxes is the way to fix that. When I look at the educational system and the fact that when we look at what we're spending on education in Oregon, we're actually spending more per capita than Washington or California, but we're not seeing the results. When I look at some of the systemic solutions, I think we need to look at how do we build infrastructure that's going to be sustainable. We don't want to dampen enthusiasm for the business community of any size to invest in our community. I've talked to constituents that are very, very concerned. I talked to one who indicated to me he will never open another business in Oregon because of the regulation, where he feels like it is basically chased him out. So what I'd like to see us do is let's focus on the big issues, let's focus on local issues, because I think the leadership that is going to address the issues for District 11 and the issues that are going to address what is going on in Oregon are going to come from Oregon. They're not going to come nationally. And I feel like my track record of reaching across the aisle, of working with community groups, and building that kind of infrastructure prepares me for that role. Thanks for your time, thanks for your questions, and I hope I've earned your vote.
Thank you to Mark Herbert and Marty Wilde, both running for Oregon House District 11. Thanks to the City Club of Eugene and the League of Women Voters. I'm Rachel McDonald with KLCC.
Before we conclude, I would like to thank our gold sponsors, Banner Bank, Evans, Elder, Brown, and Subert, Dr. Sandy Ybarra of Hearing Associates, and to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9 Radio, Dot Dots and Photography. I talked too long. PacInfo and Simplified Computing, LLC. Next week, the candidates for Oregon House District 14 race, candidates Rich Cunningham and Julie Fahey. As you know, on October 19th, we have the race for Congressional District 4 with Pete DeFazio, Art Robinson, and Mike Bielson. And as you may not know, November 2nd, be here early, Senator Ron Wyden on the Friday before Election Day is going to talk about election security and a new bill that he has introduced. Get your tickets early. We would like to thank Rachel McDonald for an excellent job moderating, and to our candidates for a wonderfully civil discussion. Mark Herbert and Marty Wilde, thank you. That concludes today's program.